It's Richard Moore here. Before we hear this week's episode, we have some very sad news. It was reported on Tuesday evening and then confirmed by his team that Nicolas Portal, the former rider and more recently sports director at Team Sky and Team Ineos, has died from a suspected heart attack. He was 40 years old. Portal was a key figure in Sky and Ineos's Tour de France wins. He was a highly respected and always very approachable figure.
I'm talking for the top guys out here. It's not like a crazy climb. What you don't want is to lose time on this climb. You just, if you're not ready yet on the top, because you're going to reach the peak later, you just want to follow. And if you want to attack, you try to attack and make sure, in case you've got the legs to follow the counterattack. So it will be, you know, like cat and mouse a little bit, you can say that.
This morning, you know, when you looked all the week, the three stage with the crosswind plus the time trial, we didn't plan that you could be in front the guy like Zakarin, Richie Porte or Contador. So that was just perfect, really perfect. And stage like this anyway, he's good for him, he's really punchy. So we tried to go for the stage win, obviously, and for the bonification, because it's exactly the type of stage that he liked it. That's why we make sure that we'd be happy with the breakaway, and then nobody want to clearly go for the stage win. So we said, okay, let's try it. Tomorrow is a stage where it's different, you know, it's a longer climb, so I guess who had the legs will be better. Today, obviously, you need to bring back the breakaway, so that's why we say, okay, let's boys try to do it, and then we have no regrets.
It's hard to know. I mean, I didn't talk to Egan, like I said before, you know, and he's not the only one not follow this attack. There's all of the secondary and they couldn't follow, so you might be a little bit blocked or whatever, or just on the limit and say, right, what I should go is still, you know, a few K to go, and it was also Jay coming back. I have no teammates, so I don't know, but it's been going so quick. And Alaphilippe and Pinot, they're so punchy. And sometimes, you know, I mean, fair play to them. They've been doing both. They're being where they went. Must be pretty exciting on TV.
Nicolas Portal. We send our deepest condolences to his family and friends. The episode you're about to hear was recorded a few hours before we heard the sad news about Nicolas Portal. We'll have a full appreciation of Portal in next week's podcast.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWalker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Daniel Freib.
Hello.
Daniele Friberincini.
Live.
Live, yeah. He's actually sitting beside me here. It's so strange. And we're not with Lionel Burney. Where are you, Lionel?
Hello, Richard. I'm on the North Norfolk coast having a few days getting away from it all, really.
In quarantine?
Playing a bit of golf, napalm?
Not yet.
Some nice courses up there, Cromer, Sheringham.
Well, we're basically, that's where we are. No, haven't brought my golf clubs.
Get the bats out.
Or my bike. Just enjoying the late winter, early spring sunshine here in Norfolk. It's delightful out there. I'm looking forward to joining the rest of my family after we've recorded the podcast.
Well, first things first, everybody. People will be sitting, listening to this, scratching their heads. You'll have noticed from the opening to this week's podcast that we have a new title sponsor. And we're delighted to welcome iWalker to the Cycling Podcast.
Yeah, fantastic to fill the space in our title sponsorship with iWalker. We'll tell you, the listeners, a bit more about them and why they're sponsoring the Cycling Podcast a little later on. But we're incredibly grateful to iWalker because, their sponsorship enables us to continue with our planned coverage of the cycling season. Hopefully, all three Grand Tours. I say hopefully because everything's all a bit up in the air at the moment with the coronavirus. But we will still be producing podcasts no matter what happens. So welcome to iWalker.
Yes, welcome. And I was over at opening weekend wondering if it might be closing weekend as well. Lots of, you would have hated it, Daniel, because there was a lot of fist bumping at Het Nieuwsblad and Kuna Brussels. Kuna, you don't like fist bumping, do you?
You just portray me as some kind of misanthropic, I think, refuse Nick who hates everything.
No, I think you object to it among a certain age of men, don't you?
I was once the victim of a fist bump from Bob Stapleton.
The unwitting victim of a fist bump.
Yeah, Bob Stapleton, the former manager of the HTC Columbia team. Yeah, I can't remember. I think I told a joke that he thought was quite funny, so he thought it was appropriate to go in for the fist bump, and I recoiled.
I'm sure you scowled appropriately at that. But Lionel, yeah, I mean, it's strange not having you with us, Lionel. You're on holiday. Did you watch much of the racing at the weekend?
I watched all of the opening weekend at the weekend and kept a very keen eye on the World Track Championships as well. The coronavirus, I don't mind admitting, you know, my dislike for speculation, it's off the chart. I just don't know what's happening. It's very unsettling at the moment for the world of sport and for the world, I guess. But the news roundup, let's start with the Track World Championships in Berlin. The Netherlands topped the medal table. They absolutely dominated all of the men's sprinting. But the outstanding stories were the world records in the pursuiting, really. A new world team pursuit record for Denmark. They broke it in the qualifying round, the first round, and then the final against New Zealand. And it now stands at 3 minutes 44.672 seconds. And it made me think back to the 1999 World Track Championships in Berlin, which was the first World Track Champs that I covered 21 years ago, of course, now. And the talk that week was whether the Germans would be able to break the 4 minute barrier, which they eventually did at the Sydney Olympics in 2000. It's incredible that effectively in kind of, I know the mathematicians will probably raise an eyebrow at this, but they're effectively going a lap quicker now, aren't they? You know, lapping at sort of 15 seconds. 3:44.672, extremely rapid. And well, it's going to set up a fantastic team pursuit competition at the Tokyo Olympics later this year.
A bit of fag packet analysis insight from you boys. You know your track cycling, your indoor cycling. What's happened? Why are they going so fast?
Well, Dan Bigham is helping out with the Danes, isn't he? I mean, he is obviously of Who But What Bike, featured on the podcast last year, around this time, I guess, and a real kind of genius aerodynamicist, used to work in Formula One and is a great rider himself. But he may well be, you know, he's been sort of slipped through the fingers of British Cycling, or they've turned down his approaches, and he's off working with the Danes and doing a fabulous job by the looks of things. Worth mentioning as well, Gary Sutton and his work with USA Cycling, and Chloe Diger, who also smashed the women's individual pursuit record.
I saw some reference online to the change in approach in terms of the composition of the pursuit teams. That I remember it was kind of trumpeted when the British team started doing well, sort of 15 years ago, when they had one or two of a more sort of sprinter type, particularly the first who was doing the sort of star. I don't know the right terminology. You know,
this is incredible. This is the most interested Daniel's ever sounded.
Who was doing the first turn? You know. And I understand now that that it's moved towards kind of sprinter types across the whole team.
This would be like me doing a cricket podcast, I think.
Daniel, the formation in team pursuiting is 1-1-1-1. So the person you're thinking of is the guy who's playing up front.
Yeah.
So they're basically playing with four strikers now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a sprint event.
It's a sprint event, isn't it now? I mean,
sprinting is a powerlifters event.
Yeah, good way of putting it.
It's all changed. But anyway, let's move on to the road. We're on firmer ground there, I think.
Hang on a minute.
Oh, sorry, sorry.
We've barely scratched the surface of the Track World Championships.
Oh, apologies.
You mentioned Chloe Diger's new world record. She broke her own world record, of course, and in the final, she beat Lisa Brennauer of Germany, lowering the world record to 3:16.937. And in the men's individual pursuit, Filippo Ganna broke his own world record in the qualifying round. That now stands at 4:01.934. The 4 minute barrier is in sight for the individual men now over 4 kilometres. Ganna then beat US rider Ashton Lambie, who also has a Who What Bike connection, in the final. The bronze medalist was Corentin Ermanno, the son of Philippe, who was beaten beaten by Graham O'Bree in the 1993 World Individual Pursuit Final in Norway. Ermanno Senior also won the title in 97 and 98. Not a great week for the British riders. Eleanor Barker was the outstanding success again, as she was a few years ago in Hong Kong. She won the points race, the only gold medal for the British. There were silver medals in the women's team pursuit and a couple of bronzes in the men's team sprint and the Omnium for Matt Walls. Laura Kenny, who crashed in the last round of the World Cup, also crashed in the Omnium. She needed stitches in a wound in her head and looked a bit dazed. But not a great World Championships for the Great Britain team. And with the Olympics only months away now, well, we're accustomed to seeing them perform a bit better in the World Championships directly before the Olympics, aren't we? The other story from Berlin was that the Danish rider Mikkel Mørkøv won the Madison with Lasse Norman Hansen, having travelled from the UAE tour and then spending, I think, 48 hours in quarantine before getting on the track. Concerns that maybe he had contracted coronavirus. And, well, that leads on to the UAE tour, which was curtailed, cut short by two stages. Tadej Pogacar won the second leg on Jabel Hafeet, but the race was cancelled after that fifth stage with two remaining, and Adam Yates was declared the winner. Then the whole race entourage, all of the teams, everyone working on the race was pretty much in lockdown over the weekend. The teams are now home, apart from Cofidis, Groupama, FDJ and Gazprom. Riders are still, as we record now, in the UAE. UAE Team Emirates have also stayed voluntarily. So we'll talk about the coronavirus and its impact on the sport.
In the works for Pog and his Paris-Nice ambitions.
Gaviria as well. I mean, quite a devastating blow for team for UAE Team Emirates. We'll hear from Alan Piper, their sports director, who I spoke to about their voluntary quarantine. So we'll hear from him a bit later on.
Well, the coronavirus has already started disrupting riders' plans. Wout van Aert was not going to ride Omloop Het Nieuwsblad at the weekend, but because the risk of Strade Bianca being cancelled, he decided to line up in Ghent. Julian Alaphilippe has already said he's not going to race Milan-San Remo. That's nothing to do with the coronavirus, but will anyone race Milan-San Remo? We don't know at the moment. Let's talk about the opening weekend races very briefly, because we'll discuss those in the first part. Jasper Stuyven of Trek Segafredo took a very impressive win on Saturday at Omloop Het Nieuwsblad, out sprinting Yves Lampaert on the line. And then the following day, Koerner Brussels Koerner, De Koenig Quicksteps, Kasper Asgreen, really, really impressive. Almost a textbook carbon copy of Bob Jungel's win last year, going clear with around 28 kilometres to go and holding everybody off to win in impressive style. The other story from Koerner Brussels Koerner was the disqualification of Gianni Moscon of Team Ineos for throwing a bike at another rider as they were all picking themselves up off the ground following a crash. We'll talk about that in a little bit as well. In France, Rémi Cavagna won the Ardèche Classic for De Koenig Quickstep, and Simon Clark took the Drôme Classic the following day for EF Pro Cycling. The women's races at the weekend, Annemiek van Vleuten, incredibly impressive in the women's version of Omloop Het Nieuwsblad, the world champion. Well, she did it again, didn't she? Destroyed the field, really, with a long-range attack. And on Sunday at Omloop van Het Hageland, Lorena Wiebes of the Netherlands won there. Marta Bastianelli of Italy was second on both occasions at the weekend. And a couple of stories away from the racing. Oleg Tinkoff, remember him? He's been arrested and has had to pay a £20 million bail relating to an allegation by the IRS in the United States that he filed false tax returns in 2013 and underreported his income. He's now under curfew at his Holland Park apartment and has got to stay there between 7 p.m. and 7 a.m. He's banned from airports and must stay within the M25 area, which the motorway that goes
around
London.
It's a bit
like
being on the UAE tour, isn't it?
Well, he's surrendered his passports and has to report to police three times a week. Pretty serious if you come to the attention of the IRS in the US, I gather.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWalker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWalker. If you run a business, find out more at iwalker.co.uk. iwoca.co.uk.
Well, thank you again to iWalker, as we mentioned at the start of the episode. They're our new title sponsor, and we're delighted to have them on board. Who are they exactly, Lionel?
Well, Richard, they're a company that helps small businesses with finance.
That means they lend money to businesses, is that right?
That is right.
I'm sorry, my understanding of this isn't great, so you'll have to fill me in.
Well, anyone would think we run a small business, Rich, but don't worry. They'll lend to any kind of small business, bike shops. In fact, quite a lot of their businesses that they lend money to are in the cycling industry.
Why then, Lionel, do they sponsor the Cycling Podcast?
Well, the very brief answer, and we'll hear more about this over the next year or so as our agreement with iWalker plays out over the course of the year. Basically, they're fans of cycling, and they heard that we were looking for a sponsor in the podcast, realised that a lot of our listeners probably run small businesses or know others who do, and so they got in touch. And, well, the rest is kind of history, isn't it? We came to an agreement, and they are now our title sponsors for the year.
Yes, I guess, you know, I think you've written about this in your award-winning blog, Lionel. You know, funding the podcast is a bit of a jigsaw, isn't it? And this is a pretty substantial piece, title sponsorship. If it was an image from the Tour de France, this jigsaw, it would probably be the yellow jersey, wouldn't it?
I think it would be the space in the middle of the yellow jersey reserved for the team sponsor, wouldn't it? I guess.
There are Crédit Lyonnais.
Indeed, yeah. Well, yeah, they are. I mean, that is the funding that we get from sponsorship, from advertising, and from our friends of the podcast all build up the jigsaw of funding. There's no one single source of income for the Cycling Podcast. So, yeah, iWalker's support is really important to us, and it means that we can continue with our programme of, well, last year, over 150 episodes of the Cycling Podcast, all three Grand Tours covered daily on the ground, lots of other races. So, yeah, thank you very much to iWalker, and welcome to the Cycling Podcast.
It was funny, chaps. I was having a conversation with someone yesterday about our funding model. Another one of my chance encounters, John Degenkolb, last week. Yesterday, I was on a flight back from Mallorca, and I was sitting next to Mick Bennett, the Tour de France, he wishes, Tour of Britain director, regular listener, and Mick, he's a great supporter of the podcast.
Regular listener, but close listener?
Close listener, very, very supportive of the podcast. He said, he was raving to me about the podcast. He was saying, you know, my favourite is the Bulldog. And I said, what? I said, Mick, what? And he said, you know, what's he called, the Bulldog, or is it the Bison? And I said, what? And he said, the Buffalo. And I said, no. I said, I get that. I get who you mean. But how can he be your favourite?
A nice Midlands accent there, though. Yeah. That was well done.
Well, it comes naturally.
The apple doesn't fall far. What?
Yeah, it comes very naturally. I just haven't heard it before. Shall we talk about some bike racing, chaps, while we can? I was over in Belgium for the weekend at
Okay, Bulldog. He did actually. Mick was actually calling you the Bulldog. Anyway,
the Bulldog.
Go on.
At Het Nieuwsblad on Saturday and Kuurne Brussels Kuurne on Sunday. I was in the drops team car on Saturday for behind the women's race, actually, so I had a good view of that and Annemiek van Vleuten's incredible attack on the Moor. It wasn't really attack, she just rode everybody off her wheel, but we'll have a lengthy report from that in the next Cycling Podcast Femina. And I got to the finish and was there in good time to watch the men's race unfold, and especially in the later stages. And it was a very impressive win by Jasper Stuyven, wasn't it? De Koenig Quickstep, again, you know, had numbers up there. And I think Yves Lampaert is always the bridesmaid, isn't he? He's going to get a big win at some point. Didn't quite happen for him on Saturday. On Sunday, I noticed that in Kuurne, he arrived at the finish with a very bloody hip, having been knocked off his bike, apparently, by a car in the closing stages. But they were happy on Sunday, obviously. Kasper Asgreen's quite incredible win. But Het Nieuwsblad, Lionel, what did you make of that?
Yeah, I was communicating with Daniel on Saturday afternoon as the race was unfolding, and I must admit, after 71 kilometres, with 71 kilometres to go, when that break went clear, I did think that is it. The gap went up so quickly, and the group was very powerful. It obviously had the eventual winner Jasper Stuyven in there, two riders from De Koninck Quickstep, Lampert and Tim de Klerk, the diesel engine of the peloton really, and then a lot of other quality: Matteo Trentin, Mike Tönnesen, Søren Kraut Andersen, who took third place on the podium, and Jonas Rutsch of EF Pro Cycling. And the way that they got clear, and there was really no initial reaction behind, and once the gap got up to sort of nudging 2.5 minutes with 50-ish k to go, it was clear that the race was done. There was a kind of reaction behind, first of all from Lucas Postelberger, and then from Wout van Aert and Sepp van Marke, who that all coagulated together into a decent chase group. But the front group had it sewn up from a long way out, and then it was a case of who was going to win the sprint once the three had got away. And really, from there was quite a bit of intrigue when they were after the separation, the selection had been made on the Mur. That was the moment of the race, wasn't it? The way the two powered away, and then the run into the Bosberg with Matteo Trentin chasing what was then a three-man group. But then once they got onto that flat bit of road, a false flat as well, and then turned onto the main road, the race was kind of done and dusted. So it's almost like a classic by numbers, really. There wasn't a tremendous amount of intrigue, but Daniel made the point, perhaps, we see these races so often, you can kind of pinpoint the moment that that's not going to come back together, and the race was between those seven riders from a long way out.
Yeah, I think that's right, Napalm. Certainly it was a really impressive ride by Stuyven. It's been coming, from Stuyven. He didn't have a particularly good classic season last year. But, riders like him, they have to stake so much on such a short period that if they get it slightly wrong, they end up looking as though they've had a terrible year or a terrible classics campaign. And the margins are very fine. I thought 2 years ago he was very strong in the classics, and didn't really get that much recognition for it, a lot of sort of fifth to seventh, eighth places. Last year he was more sort of 10th to 20th in a lot of the big races. But he's a guy who, he was the strongest on the Mur, looked really smooth on the Mur. He's almost quick enough to be a bunch sprinter, and he's got great pedigree. He was a fantastic junior. He was the junior world champion in 2010. There was a lot of hype about him back then, so much so that I believe one of the reasons that he signed for Axel Merckx's team in the US at the time, Bontrager, Livstrong, I think it was called at the time, was to sort of escape some of that pressure. And I think people maybe look at Stuyven and they have seen in the past a bit of a sort of flash Harry, kind of carries himself with a bit of a swagger, and his results haven't necessarily sort of justified that up until quite recently or up until now. But I think he's going to be one of the main contenders in Flanders and in Roubaix. But the question mark is always when someone wins Het Nieuwsblad, whether they're going to be able to sustain it until then, because it's how long is it until Flanders? 6 weeks.
Am I right in thinking he's not a Flandrian? He's from Leuven, isn't he?
Correct.
Stuyven from Leuven.
Got expelled from school. Did you know that?
Yeah. Oh, goodness. What for?
Not sure. Talking about it.
We'll look into that. It was very impressive by him. I want to mention Sunweb briefly, because they, having lost Tom Dumoulin, they have come into this year with a big focus on the classics and are trying to sort of reinvent themselves as a classics team. So a podium for Søren Kraut Andersen, pretty promising start. I thought Tesh Benoot was impressive for them as well, his first race for them. But I spoke to Mark Reith, their sports director at the finish. He was very unhappy with the rest of the team, actually. I think he was happy with Kraut Andersen and Benoot, but the others had kind of gone missing. But I think it's quite interesting for a team like that, who've had, having Dumoulin on the team has swallowed up so many resources and energy and focus. They kind of feel quite reinvigorated, I think, by the challenge this year.
Yeah, on Crowe Anderson, that was his first race of the season, as it was the first race of the season for Matteo Trentin as well. And I wonder whether that maybe was a slight difference, because Stuyven and Lampert have raced. They've recently just done the Tour of the Algarve, so had a bit of top end in their legs. It must be, I mean, lining up for your first event of the season at Het Nieuwsblad, that strikes me as unconventional. I mean, I'm sure it's happened.
It seems to be a Sunweb thing. I don't think Michael Matthews has raced yet this year, and it was Benoit's first race of the year too. So, yeah, it seems to be a Sunweb thing, that.
I mean, it's a bit like getting on the running treadmill in the gym with it set at sort of, I don't know, running speeds, but what, 18 kilometres an hour or something, and having to sprint straight away. I mean, it's... I don't know. Maybe sports scientists would tell me different. But it struck me as impressive that they were up there in the mix, having not raced yet this year.
Sunday, Kurna, what did you make of that? I mean, it's been quite a good race the last couple of years, thanks to Jungels and Askren at the weekend there, because it has been a bit of a, I mentioned last week, it's a low-key race and doesn't have quite the same buzz around it as Het Nieuwsblad, and it's been a sprinter's race often, but I mean, De Koenig Quickstep played an absolute blinder, didn't they? They had Fabio Jakobsen sitting there behind waiting for the sprint, and a man up the road, which really put the pressure on the other teams to try and bring him back, knowing that all the time they were bringing Jakobsen with them.
Did you see the jazz band? Sorry, Rich. Did you see the jazz
band?
Oh,
I did.
De Koura.
Oh, in fact, do you want to hear a bit of the brass band? Here's a bit of the brass band from Sunday.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
Well, Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour at the Tour de France, interrupts this week's cycling podcast to remind me to tell you that this is sponsored by HelloFresh. Now, HelloFresh makes cooking from scratch easy and convenient, as well as delivering fresh, quality, pre-proportioned ingredients to your door. They now have 21 different recipes to choose from each week, from family favourites and balanced recipes under 600 calories to recipes that are on the table in 10 minutes flat. There's something for everyone to try. And to make mealtime is even more memorable, you can also add extras like desserts and artisan bread for extra convenience. Lionel, what have you been cooking up in the kitchen?
Well, Rich, I actually enjoy cooking a lot since I've been taking delivery of HelloFresh, because it takes all of the stress out of realizing that, you know, you're missing a herb or a spice. You don't feel like you're compromising on, you know, the taste that you can get into the meal, and everything's already measured out, so you're not faffing around with tablespoons and teaspoons, and you don't have to get the weighing scales out. Everything comes already prepped and ready to go, really. All you've got to do is the actual cooking part, which is, let's face it, the enjoyable bit, second only to the eating bit, which is, of course, the most enjoyable part of any mealtime, isn't it? So from my point of view, the thing I've enjoyed most about it is the variety of the recipes. You can go through and choose from 21 different recipes a week, so there's something for everyone. I know, Richard, you've been following a vegetarian diet for the last few months, so no problems choosing vegetarian meals. And we actually try to mix it up and have three vegetarian meals and only a couple of meat meals a week. So that's been something that's changed my eating habits quite significantly.
Well, for the simple way to cook fresh, HelloFresh is offering you 50% off your first box and 35% off your next three boxes. Head to hellofresh.co.uk and use the code CYCLING, that's CYCLING, to receive 50% off your first box and 35% off your next three today. A bit of a blast of the brass band that we always see at Kuurne Brussels. Kuurne wearing their old cycling jerseys.
Any donkeys? Is there some ritual involving a donkey, isn't there?
It's a bit dubious.
Do they get awarded a donkey if they win the race?
Yeah, you get awarded a donkey, don't you?
Stuffed donkey,
right?
Yeah.
Napalm?
Yeah,
stuffed donkey. Okay. Well, Askren's more of a racehorse, isn't he?
Oh, I see what you did there. Yeah. I see what that was all about.
another sort of gem who's been unearthed by the Coin It Quick Step. He, if you remember, they signed him, didn't they, from Virtu, at the time, Bjarne Riis managed team, a couple of years ago. I think he went to a training camp at the end of 2017 on trial with De Koninck and impressed them, but they didn't have a spot in their roster. But then 3 or 4 months into the following season, so 2018, they had some injuries, they had some issues, and they felt there was a space for him. So they took him on. And since then, he soared, really. Last year was third in Tour of California. So one of those riders...
Second Tour of Flanders as well.
Second in Tour of Flanders. So one of those riders who has such a sort of broad palette of abilities that you don't really know how his career is going to develop. He was also, I don't know if you remember, he was very, very strong in Kurna last year, but by his own admission after the race admitted that he'd ridden very poorly
like a donkey.
So expended a lot of energy sort of bridging gaps and clearly learned his lesson. And he's one of those guys who sort of classically, if he gets any kind of daylight in front of a bunch, if you see Asgreen go off the front, then it's sort of panic stations immediately, or it should be in the peloton.
Jungels as well, I guess has done it, Liège Best on the Edge and in Kurna last year, and I think he went a little bit earlier at the weekend, and then Asgreen. It was a great plan. I spoke to the sports director Rick Van Slick at the finish, who reflected on a pretty good weekend, second on Saturday and first on Sunday.
Yeah, perfect. It's what the boss and we are dreaming of. Unfortunately, yesterday with the second place, we have to be happy because Teuven was very strong and he's faster. But at the other hand, also Yves beat him a few times. So it was 50-50 and he won, okay. So yes, we are very happy with a nice performance from the team this weekend.
And today, I mean, you had a very fast sprinter, but you had a few riders, Bob Jungels did it last year, who could maybe go from a bit further out. Was the plan to just play one of those cards with Fabio's backup?
Well, in a certain moment, like 40k to go, there was a little group and we had only Stibar in, so then we decided to take the race in hands and said, okay guys, from now we decide what's going to happen in the peloton. So we closed the gap to the group and from there we put it out. First Bob hit them hard. And then we saw there was some cracks in the team, so we said, yeah, we have to give it another try. And then Kasper could go in the breakaway. And of course, you have to be very strong because it was a super performance what he did today. But that's the way we're racing. We try to make the other ones suffer a little bit more. And we still have the key with Fabio in the peloton instead of a bunch sprint. So that was our tactic today. Maybe some other race will be different, but for today, that was for us like the most possible.
And for the other Belgian classics coming up, I mean, you've got Lampert, Asgreen, Alaphilippe's coming in for some of those as well. So you've got, it looks like, quite a lot of options rather than a clear leader.
Yes, but that's also what makes it difficult for the other teams, and it makes a little bit more easy for us if we have more cards to play in the final or in the pre-final of a race, then you always have a little bit of advantage. So that's also a little bit the DNA of our team. Some teams have struggled to get work a few big names together, and every time when they come to us, every time we have big names, big leaders, and they all we managed to make them work together and go for the win, and they also win. So that means that it works well, and it's nice to see that they are, the base is good, they are ready, and now we have to build up and hope that the season can go on as it planned. Because with all the troubles, that they don't cancel too much races, because then it will be difficult, but that will be for everybody.
And Alaphilippe, is Flanders a big target for him?
Well, he was just like looking for some new targets, from new experience. If a rider as Alaphilippe wants something and it's possible, we try to find a way to give it to him. And if it makes him happy and also focused, it might be also be very spectacular if he's coming into Flanders. But also, we have to be realistic. It's a lightweight rider, and on Flanders couples, they suffer a little bit more than the others, but we will see. We give him a chance, and so far we stick to the plan, so we'll see.
Well, people will be wondering why the donkey references. Basically, the people of Kerna are nicknamed the Donkeys by people from nearby Cortric, and one of the reasons, one of the explanations, is because the market traders from Kerna would arrive at Cortric Market with their donkey-drawn carts laden with vegetables, and the people of Cortric just called them asses or donkeys. So there we are. That's why the winner gets a stuffed donkey on the podium. Just on to Koenig Quickstep and their success at Kerna Brussels Kerna. I mean, they really love that race. They've won now 8 of the last 15 editions, and that's in a complete contrast to their record at Omloop Het Nieuwsblad recently. ZNX D-Bar's win there last year, their only one in the last 15 years. So there's clearly something about Kerna Brussels Kerna that De Koenig Quickstep like. They're even more successful there than they are in the Tour of Flanders, where they've won 7 of the last 15. I don't really know what the reason for that is. Maybe do they get a rocket for not winning Omloop Het Nieuwsblad on Saturday night and then raise their game on Sunday? That could be one explanation.
Could be. They've had some sort of famous cock-ups, haven't they, in Omloop over the last few years. But just sort of looking ahead to Flanders, speculation, Napalm, but, you know, just looking at the sort of riders that they'll be able to count on in Flanders, Jungels, Lampert, Asgreen, Stibar, and of course Alaphilippe is going to ride Flanders. And slightly controversially from an Italian point of view, he's not going to ride San Remo. Controversial?
Well, talking of controversy, Gianni Moscon back in hot water again, disqualified from the race for throwing his bike at another rider when they were all on the side of the road after a crash. Obviously, frustrating enough to crash, but a reaction that can't really be condoned or accepted. And then a little while later, obviously, as the news from the commissaire reached Moscon that he'd been disqualified, he was shown on the camera tearing up his race numbers, and Richard, as you said, compounding the first offence by littering. Not a good day again for Moscon.
The heat of the moment, you can almost understand the frustration that would lead to the bike throw.
I don't think the aggressive manner in which he threw the bike with someone in the crosshairs was really understandable.
I'm not trying to excuse it at all, but I can understand that in that particular moment that he lost control. When he's told then that he's been disqualified, the attitude in, you know, just ripping his numbers off and throwing them away, I just thought it showed contempt, you know, not as dangerous, certainly. But just contempt. I mean, I think in a moment like that, and especially with his track record and the sort of pattern of behaviour, show a bit of humility. But that doesn't seem to be really in his makeup, does it? I mean, the incident itself, had it been any other rider, we probably wouldn't be talking about it quite so much. It would be dismissed as a one-off, a kind of heat of the moment thing. But with Moscon, there is this pattern.
Did you chaps expect or think that he could possibly be sacked after that incident?
Well, that wasn't my impression speaking to the sports director, Gabriel Rash, at the finish. He arrived back at the team bus quite a bit after the finish because he'd been talking to the race jury. I think he hadn't really seen it properly in the car. He'd been watching it on his phone and he didn't feel like he'd had a proper view. So he went to see the race jury. That strikes me as a perfectly understandable, normal thing to do, to review exactly what he'd been disqualified for. Let's hear what Gabriel Rash said when he arrived back at the Team Ineos bus about an hour or so after the finish.
So you were speaking to the race jury there, I think. What was that, just to find out what the disqualification was for?
They wanted to show me the pictures on the big screen so I could see, because you sit in the car and have small TVs and you can't really, or on the phone, so you can't really see 100% what happened, I agree in the decision. It's not something that should happen.
So no grounds for any kind of complaint or appeal then?
No. I think it's not it's not acceptable what happened, really.
And what now for Gianni Moscon, because he's been involved in a few incidents now. You know, the last time I think he was sent home from the Tour de France, I think he was on a kind of final warning then. What might happen to him now?
We have to speak to him now, and it's something we're working on and have to continue working on, definitely. It's more, I think, it's more supporting him, really, and doing the right things so it doesn't happen again, but you never have any guarantees.
Have you managed to speak to him at all yet?
I spoke with him briefly when we passed him, but we didn't have much time. We had to go follow the race, really.
Can I ask one final question? Sorry. Just from a racing point of view, you know, disappointing day yesterday, and today we saw quite a lot of Ian Stannard and Luke Rowe bringing it back at the end. I mean, I guess from a racing point of view, you could have done with him in the finale today.
Yeah, well, we could. Swifty wasn't far off, didn't have the best position into the last sprint. It was a little bit too far behind there, but I think, you know, we're trying to redo our view on the classics, trying to do things in a new way, and because we haven't been that good in the classics the last year, so it's a start for us, and now we have to see what we did right and see what we did wrong and continue from there, really.
So I was Gabriel Rash, sports director at Team Ineos. He was just staring at his feet while he was talking and didn't try to excuse Moscon at all, felt that it was the right decision to disqualify him, but did suggest that the next step will be offering him more support rather than punishing him, which some people will raise their eyebrows at, because I don't know, Napalm, if you've got the charge sheet in front of you for Moscon, it's fairly lengthy now.
Yeah, Rich, you say if it hadn't been Moscon, if it had been any other rider, that it wouldn't be such a talking point, and that certainly is true, but Moscon is racking up quite a list of incidents, isn't he? In the 2017 Tour of Romandy, he racially abused Kevin Reiser and was suspended from racing by Team Sky for 6 weeks. He went on a some kind of an awareness course, didn't he, after that, that Team Sky arranged. And then later on in the season, after his comeback, he was accused of deliberately crashing into Sebastian Reichenbach, a teammate of Kevin Reiser's. And although that investigation was dropped because of a lack of evidence, you know, it was quite a story at the time. Then at the World Championships in 2017, you know, a few weeks later, he was disqualified, having held on to the team car for quite a lot of, an unacceptable amount of time. I mean, the footage that emerged of that, it was absolutely ridiculous. And then at the 2018 Tour de France, he was disqualified for lashing out with his fists at Elie Gesbert of the Fortuneo Samsic team, and now this latest incident at Kerner Brussels Kerner. So, four or five really serious incidents there that have all led to disqualification or some kind of sanction. And, they're adding up. And I guess, you know, I do understand the need to support someone who clearly has issues with controlling impulses, urges, maybe temper as well. But at some point, does there not have to be a sort of firm lead shown? And I guess, Daniel's made this point before, that it comes down to whether that Moscon is talented enough to keep getting away with incidents like this. And it's a fact, isn't it, in sport that wayward genius will be tolerated a lot more than wayward mediocrity.
Yeah, and I think you have to be clear when people talk about helping Moscon, the fact that he needs to be helped. Ineos have, I think, done that, and they might well continue to do that, but they will only do so if they think there's something for them at the end of that process. process, you know, if they think the juice is worth the squeeze. You know, this idea that they're just helping him because that's the right thing, that because they're accompanying him on a spiritual journey, is pretty unrealistic. I mean, it's not cynical to, you know, for them to act in their own interest. And, you know, is he worth it? Well, if you look at his results, the last year wasn't great, particularly the Cobble Classics, where they would expect him to do well and you know, be contending for these races. He was 42nd in Flanders, 84th in Roubaix. But then, and this maybe partly explains why Ineos struggle in the Cobble Classics. They have a number of riders. Luke Rowe is another one, for whom, you know, the whole season doesn't rest on the Cobble Classics, and there is a role for them, and probably the most important role they have in the team is in the major tours. And Moscon was excellent in the Tour de France last year. He is one of the very rare riders, very few riders in the peloton who really can do pretty much everything. You know, he's a rider who in theory on his best day could contend for all five of the monuments. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Moneyball and you know, Billy Beane's sort of tenets of basically extracting a lot from very little in baseball. And he talked about a five-tool baseball player, basically a player who could do everything. I mean, I sort of, when you think about five-tool cyclists, you know, cyclists who can climb, he can sprint, he's good on the flat at sort of helping a leader, he can time trial, and he's also resilient, he can recover. There aren't that many of those in the peloton. And since we've transitioned to eight-man teams, those riders have become even more important, and there are not an awful lot of them. I mean, if I think about riders in that vein, I think of sort of Oliver Naarsen, and Ineos have actually founded a lot of their success in Grand Tours on those riders rather than sort of specialist climbing domestiques. They've actually had three or four riders who almost do a double job. So, you know, the Moscons, the Kwiatkowski is now, they've got Amador, even Luke Rowe on a good day can do a job on the first half of a long climb. So, you know, when you think about whether Ineos will consider him expendable, I think you have to focus on that part of what he can do rather than perhaps, you know, what he might win.
Just on you know, Moscon's place in the peloton as well. I mean, the quite a few riders kind of made comments on Twitter, and I do think there's a broader thing at stake here, and that is the sort of the implicit trust between the riders that they're not going to do things that are, you know, really unpredictable and might place other people in danger. And you know, I know the race had, you know, ground to a halt for those riders that were by the side of the road, but when you're picking yourself up off the ground after a crash, you know, being then hit by a bike, you know, regardless of, you know, whose fault the crash was, or, you know, whatever, the, you know, the temper's running high, and the shock of having just hit the ground, and the frustration of being, you know, disadvantaged, all of those things, really, there is a kind of a not just an implied requirement, there is a requirement that's placed on all the riders to kind of keep tempers in check at those moments of high stress. And I think the kind of backlash from a few riders on social media will be more quietly echoed and felt by a lot of the other riders in the peloton. They don't want a loose cannon in their midst.
And you mentioned all the incidents that we know about Lyle, for which he's been punished. And, you know, it reminds me a bit of the Peter Sagan incident a few years ago at the Tour de France, where he was disqualified for his manoeuvre on Mark Cavendish. I'm not putting him in the same category at all, but the severity of his punishment at the time was explained by a few riders, or speculated about, as a kind of a cumulative punishment based on his general recklessness sometimes in finishes. And I think with Moscon, we know what we've seen, and, you know, speaking to other riders and even teammates of Moscon's, you know, I've heard him described as a man on the edge, as somebody who is often, you know, kind of a guy to be avoided, that there's this, that he's kind of waiting to go off. He's a hothead, and that means that, you know, until or unless he can get that aspect of his personality under control, he's going to carry on being a liability.
you know, it's difficult to know where it comes from, because you look at his sort of backstories. This kid from a rural area of north of Italy, just outside Trento. His family are apple farmers, and you know, you speak to him, he seems actually, and if you look back at interviews that were done with him when he was an amateur, often the journalist talks about how sort of quiet and calm he is, but he obviously has this other side to his character. He plays the organ in the off season. That's one of the things he likes to do. Helps his dad on the apple farm. There was a good story actually, Rich. He used to go out with an Italian female rider, Sofia Bertizzolo, I think her name is, and he
rode well at Het Nieuwsblad on Saturday. Actually, she rides for CCC now. A bit of a story about her trying to join Movistar and not being allowed to under Spanish employment laws or Italian employment laws.
Well, Moscon pursued her, and he managed to get her phone number, but she wasn't very keen at first, and his solution was to phone her up and pretend to be a journalist, and he conducted quite a long interview with her, apparently, and she had no idea that it was him and it wasn't a journalist. And the big reveal came 2 or 3 weeks later. I don't know whether it was Moscon or someone else who told her that it wasn't actually a journalist, it was him. But eventually, you know, he
wore her down.
He wore her down.
Nothing like kicking off a relationship with an act of total dishonesty. Amazing.
But just putting yourself in Ineos's position now, chaps, what would you do with Moscon? I think his contract's up at the end of the year. At this point, you would have to think that they would be reluctant to renew it, but who knows? And also, would you sign him?
What if he wins Paris-Roubaix? You know, that's the thing. He went close a few years ago at Paris-Roubaix. That's what it'll boil down to. I think another team probably would sign him, because I think everybody would think that they could work their magic on him. You would have to think that you've got to, you know, the talent is there. You've got to be able to get that out of him without provoking those sides of his personality that are less pleasant and quite dangerous at times. I think it's a kind of hypothetical question, because if somebody will sign him, you know, he's not going to be left on the scrap heap, is he? He's talented enough that somebody would sign him.
He's also got an agent, Giovanni Lombardi, who has other very good riders, which, you know, and that will give some leverage in negotiations, trying to place him in other teams.
Would you sign him, Lionel?
I probably wouldn't, no. But I also wouldn't sack him. I would, you know, he's got a contract to the end of the year. I would take it as a duty of care to try and work on his his issues, get him the help and support that he needs, and then it's difficult, isn't it? Then it sounds almost callous that you just let his contract run down and release him. I think you're absolutely right that it comes down to results. If he wins big races and or is a big help to the team in the Tour de France, then they'll keep him, and they'll tolerate the they'll tolerate these indiscretions until either the indiscretions become so so serious that they have no choice, or he rehabilitates himself and behaves more reasonably.
I think the problem, one major problem he's got and Ineos have got now, is that I sort of drew a parallel on Twitter the other day about there are lots of young athletes that have disciplinary problems early in their career, and then they suddenly something clicks, or something a switch flicks in their head, and you know they move beyond the problems. And one issue now with Moscon is that if he is riding in a peloton which is hostile towards him, you can imagine that could well lead to further flare-ups. And that's quite a difficult sort of situation, position.
It could be like, in football, where if a player is hot-headed, the other team will target him. You know, will other teams target Gianni Moscon? Because in eight-man teams at the Tour, take Moscon out early doors, and, you know, Tony Martin...
raspberries at him and Tony sticking Martin. Their tongue out at him. And
yeah, I don't know, leaning over and putting his brakes on and stuff like that.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport. Fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science and Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. And you can get 25% off your Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25 for 25% off. Lionel, I think you and I are going to have a little treat from Science and Sport for next week's recording. A new product is coming out this week, and we're being sent some. And they sound very nice indeed. So I think we'll be having them with our coffee
taste
next week.
Lovely.
Excellent. I'm looking forward to receiving those. Chaps, we're going to go on and talk about coronavirus and the UAE tour, but before we do, just before we move off the racing completely, a few riders caught my eye at the weekend, the young riders in particular. There was an 18-year-old riding for Trek Segafredo at Het Nieuwsblad and Koerner Brussels Koerner, Quinn Simmons, the junior world champion. Doesn't look 18, I have to say. He's got a big bushy beard and quite a big guy. 20-year-old Fred Wright as well was riding for Bahrain McLaren, and 20-year-old Matthew Jorgensen riding for Movistar. Lots of very young riders in action at the weekend. I spoke to Quinn Simmons after Het Nieuwsblad, and then I spoke to Fred Wright, the Londoner, on Team Barry McLaren at the start of Koerner Brussels Koerner on Sunday morning. Let's hear from them both now. Quinn Simmons first, and then Fred Wright.
Are you surprised at 18 years old to find yourself riding races like this?
Actually, I was looking back, and this weekend 2 years ago was my first ever road race, so that was pretty crazy. And then, yeah, but I don't know. At this point now, I've kind of moved past looking at that and just started, you know, I have a job to do, and looking forward to improving and learning how to do my job well.
Do you look at some of the other young riders, Remco Evenepoel most obviously, and think, you know, maybe I don't need to be that patient, maybe I can progress, maybe faster than we expected young riders to progress in the past?
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm not going to be patient. I think, you know, these races, anything can happen when you have the form, and, you know, with the team, you know, today I had the freedom to go on moves if I could have and just didn't have the legs, so went in full into help set up Jasper. But yeah, I mean, anything can change. There's so many opportunities through the classics, and yeah, Remco, what he does is a little different, obviously, you know, in time trial and on the climbs, you kind of have it or you don't. Here it's more of a lottery and more tactical, and I think that's going to be the hardest part to figure out, because I mean, physically I know I'm on the same level as these guys.
You obviously are, I'm guessing you must cope okay with the weather like this, because you won in Yorkshire last year, of course.
I really like racing in the rain. I think it adds another level that you don't get in a sunny race, and it just makes it that much harder. And, you know, I think if you can win a race like this, it's, you know, just that one notch harder. And I think a lot of the guys quit before the start, and if you can just embrace it and go for it, you'll have a good day.
And you see yourself being a sort of classics rider, I guess, sprinter, classics rider?
Hopefully. We'll see. I mean, I'm still young and can change, but right now it's what I feel like I'm the best at. I think, you know, as a bigger guy, and, you know, it's the races I'm the most passionate about, so it's where I'm the most motivated and, you know, what I look forward to doing the most, both as a fan and now as a rider.
And you've got 100% record in World Tour races.
Yeah, 100%. Actually, it's a pretty good record. We won with Matteo the first two races in Mallorca, yeah. And then here, so I think that's a pretty good start for my NeoPro year.
Yeah, Fred, I mean, you rode and finished yesterday. How was it yesterday?
Oh, it was brutal. Can't beat a grim day out in Belgium, that's for sure.
How did you find it, though?
I mean, it was as expected, really. Just suffering like a dog all day. But, yeah, got around.
Quite pleased with that, then.
Did what I could for the team. I mean, there's more I can do today. I'm still don't feel too battered this morning, so hopefully I'll be able to do something.
Do you know this race? You rode this race as a junior, I think, didn't you?
Yeah, although I don't really want to think about that, because I crashed three times in this race for about 30k when I was as a junior. So I think I'm pretty sure I'll have better luck doing this as a pro. I mean, it's a bit mad I'm doing it as a pro, to be honest, but yeah. Hopefully I'll have better luck.
Happy memories. And how are you settling in? I mean, you grew up in Herne Hill and riding on the track there quite a lot. When did you start cycling?
I started at Herne Hill when I was 8 or 9, I reckon. Yeah, and it's...
You're a pure product of Herne Hill.
Yeah, I am a true product of Herne Hill, that's for sure. Yeah.
And look where it gets you. So how are you settling into life with Barry McLaren?
I mean, yeah, it's great. I can't... It's just being here with a team that it's just with loads of support staff and everything. It's, and a big team bus. I mean, it's what you dream about when you're a young kid. So it's great.
Sounds like you almost can't. You're almost pinching yourself. You can't believe it.
Yeah, I mean that. Just doing that sign on yesterday in Ghent Velodrome with all the fans and everything. It was a bit like, what am I doing here? You know. Yeah, it's great.
There's a few of you young guys, like really young guys, riding these races. Do you know these other guys at all? Quinn Simmons, Matthew Jorgensen, do you know those guys quite well?
Yeah, I mean, I've raced a lot of them in the under-23s and everything like that, so it's good to see. There's a big young crop of riders coming through at the moment, so it's good to be part of that.
And you've been given chances in these races.
Yeah, that's what's great. I think these are the races that suit me, and I need to get as much experience as I can from them, and that's what doing them is all about, you know.
You're quite a big guy, and you won stages of the Tour de l'Avenir, Baby Giro last year as well. Are you a sprinter? Are you a classics rider? What do you see yourself developing into?
More, I'd like to see myself developing into someone that can do well in these sort of races. So, yeah.
But you're fast. You've got a good finish,
and,
obviously.
Yeah, and I've from doing all the track, I've still got I'm obviously not a sprinter, but I've still got a good finish on me. So, yeah.
And so will you still ride the track a bit?
Oh, I mean, I love the track. I'd still like to do a little bit here and there, just to keep the legs going through the winter, I think, yeah.
Quite a baptism of fire, isn't it? Het Nieuwsblad and Koerner Brussels Koerner for young riders. We were expecting to see Matthew van der Poel riding in Omloop Het Nieuwsblad on Saturday, but he pulled out with illness, regular flu, not coronavirus.
Apparently he's... I spoke to his team at the weekend, and he was pretty ill, very feverish, and certainly out of the question that he could ride. And he'll be trying to get better for Strade Bianche at the weekend. But you know, he's got a big season, a big program ahead of him. It might not have done him any harm to miss that weekend's racing. He was only down for Het Nieuwsblad actually, and you know he's got a very packed spring in particular. So. Heard some talk that he might have been planning to miss Amstel Gold Race, which he won last year, but this might mean that he's able to just extend his classic season into that race after all.
Well, you say he's going to ride Strade Bianche, but well, as we speak on Tuesday morning, the race goes ahead, but the whole world of sport is really up in the air with the spread of coronavirus, isn't it? The UAE Tour cut short by a couple of days, Switzerland and France kind of curtailing mass gatherings, talk of Premier League football matches perhaps being played behind closed doors if the spread of the virus isn't contained, and professional cycling is pretty vulnerable to the spread of a virus like this, really, not just in the movement of people all around Europe and the rest of the world, but you know, athletes operating at the top of their game, sort of succumbing to illnesses because they're putting their bodies to such extremes. We can only assume that Strade Bianche will go ahead at the weekend, but there has to still be some doubt as we speak, because this is just the intention of the race organisers as it stands. We haven't yet heard whether the Italian authorities are going to impose any kind of restrictions on sporting events or mass gatherings for the weekend that's coming up.
Yeah, Napalm, it's all, as you say, very uncertain at the moment, and it will be, I guess, in a lot of cases, financial considerations that might decide whether the races go ahead or not, or perhaps, to be more precise, I would say insurance policies and you know, at what point do races invalidate their insurance by going ahead or not going ahead, and they will probably defer to governments or and a sort of official directives that are coming from that level in most cases. I think in Italy the situation is sort of muddied by the fact that everything is being decided on a regional level, whereas, for example, as you said, in Switzerland there's been a national government decision, and you know, Strade Bianche takes place in in Tuscany at the moment. There are no directives preventing that from going ahead, but Milan San Remo visits three Italian regions, and one of the regions, Lombardy, is very much at the center of the outbreak there, and that's the one I think that RCS, the organizers, are most concerned about at this point.
A lot of RCS staff have been stranded in the UAE until, well, flights have been going out this morning, I think, everyone other than the three teams that are still there in quarantine. It appears
four teams.
Well, UAE is voluntary, isn't it? I mean, the other three, Cofidis, Gazprom and Groupama FDJ, are actually being prevented from leaving. It seems like the people working on the race and the journalists have are gradually moving out and getting on flights. Some arrived home yesterday, but RCS will have been disrupted by having, well, Mauro Venni, I assume, would have been in the UAE and kept there longer than anticipated, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, the situation with UAE Team Emirates is the most perplexing, really. And you get the sense now, several days into this, that patience is wearing thin. You know, what was quite a novel situation at first is not becoming very funny anymore.
Well, we've had the Cofidis director sportif Roberto Damiani threatening to go on hunger strike.
Threatening to go on hunger strike, yeah. I mean, you can understand how frustrating it would be for anybody, but for an athlete to be locked in his room and unable to train, or, you know, just unbelievably frustrating. And the most surprising decision, I suppose, is that of UAE Team Emirates. There seems to be a sort of political dimension to this, in a way, that they've self quarantined, and that's taken riders like Gaviria and Pogacar out of the game for the moment, and that's a serious decision. And I was curious about it, so I asked Alan Piper, their sports director, who was at Koerner, Brussels Koerner, about it. He just gave a brief explanation. Let's hear first from him, and then let's hear from somebody who has been out there, Jim Cotton, a journalist, friend of the podcast, who was caught up in the situation in the UAE. So we'll hear briefly from Alan Piper on his team's decision to stay out there and lock themselves up, and then from Jim Cotton.
Do you know what's happening out in Abu Dhabi? The latest is we hear that the team is remaining out there for a while. Do you know what's going on there?
Well, our team's remaining in Abu Dhabi because at the request of our sponsor, UAE, the government, just in the sense of safety, because they say that the priority is our health safety, or the people that are there, and not the sporting, you know, the races coming up. So they're staying there a few more days to do another test in 3 or 4 days to make sure everyone's fine before they go home.
How are they coping, do you know?
I would say, like everybody, wanting to get home.
And it's, I mean, you've got a couple of very important riders there, haven't you? But I guess you've got to balance that against the safety concerns.
Yep. Well, there's a lot of important riders in the UAE. So, you know, it was the same for everybody.
First of all, Jim, can you just describe your surroundings?
So I'm in the lobby of the Crown Plaza Hotel in the UAE in Abu Dhabi. It's mid-afternoon here at the moment. There's a few journalists standing around looking anxious, and the hotel's pretty empty.
But the latest is you're now able to go home quite soon, is that right?
Yes, so the initial message was that I would be home now. I was due to fly at 9 a.m. local time, and on coming down to the hotel reception to get the shuttle to the airport at about 5, the front doors had been locked and all the journalists had been held in the hotel while other just general tourists were free to leave. It was basically on the bidding of the government health authority who had decided to keep us in, whereas many of our journalist colleagues had left during the middle of the night and were on flights home.
Right, so am I right in thinking there's a bit of confusion, and there has been during this lockdown?
Yeah, the whole thing has been a complete confusion, to be honest. So all of the journalists and media types are in one hotel, and all of the peloton and the team staff and all those guys are in a hotel over the route, over the way. So we were all tested Friday, and through the whole process, through the last kind of 70 hours or so, all the journalists have been told to stay in their rooms to kind of, you know, prevent any potential kind of spread. Whereas the teams in their hotels, it was on a team by team basis, so they were tested. But then I spoke to some riders who were kind of having dinner together. I was speaking to some who were kind of isolated, and the messaging from the health authorities about the whole thing has been just a long story of confusion, basically.
I mean, there's been a lot of black humour around it, but it must have been quite scary.
Well, yeah, it was, to be honest. So there was a lot of black humour when we were initially told, don't leave, because all week, like, we'd all been joking a bit about coronavirus, and everybody, there was a noticeable sort of lots of hand sanitising and people being a bit careful. But when it kind of all kicked off, it was quite scary, to be honest. I mean, well, firstly, as everybody says, you never think it's going to happen to you. And I didn't really ever feel like it was going to happen to me. The thing that struck me first was I might be in quarantine here for 2 weeks. And, you know, given it's like where we are, like, are there different regulations? How well are we being going to, you know, how well is it going to be managed? Things like that. And, the most scary thing really is just we've not had any communication, because the difficult thing has been the guys from RCS, who have done a pretty admirable job, to be fair. They're just relying on information from the state health body, and we only really have contact with RCS. So we've been asking RCS, and they've not known the answers and have had to, you know, go to the next step up, and we've just never really known what's happening.
So that's Jim Cotton, a journalist caught out there. He, I think, has managed to make it home now, but he describes it being quite scary, and we can be a bit flippant, I think, about it. And I imagine being caught up in that situation, and, you know, being stuck in a hotel especially, would be quite... And with a disease that we don't know an awful lot about, really, we're still learning about it. It's quite frightening, really. And that is another aspect to this, isn't it? It's not just disruption, it's also, there's also fear.
I think the most perplexing thing is inconsistency in responses across different countries. As you said, Daniel, you know, Switzerland have imposed a country-wide set of restrictions, whereas Italy is operating on a regional basis. And I mean, I'm scheduled to go over to Strada Bianca on Friday, and I really don't know what to do for the best, really. Technically, Tuscany is not it's not part of the area that's been worst affected. There have been some cases in Tuscany, but I've been doing quite a bit of reading about this, and I think that it's very easy to say, oh, well, just let everything go on, you know, let business continue as usual. And while there's obviously from our point of view, we want to see the races go ahead, from a global perspective, this does need to be brought under some kind of control. And I gather from the reading I've done that the biggest concern is not the mortality rate necessarily, although that is a concern. It's not the fact that there isn't a vaccine for this particular strain of virus, although that is a concern. The main issue is the potential for hundreds of thousands of people to become ill at the same time and place unmanageable strain on health services. And that's the reason for caution, I think, from some countries, the risk of it spreading and really affecting a huge number of people all at once is the thing that everybody wants to avoid. And so it seems to me kind of odd that, you know, in Italy football matches have been cancelled in some areas but not in others, and yet fans have travelled from affected areas into areas that have been less badly affected. There's, you know, a real kind of inconsistency when the message seems to be that the virus is very easily spread and highly contagious. So I really don't know what is best. You know, how many flights will be going in and out of Milan, for example, specifically with people travelling to Strada Bianchi a few hundred kilometres further south. I mean, I'm not an expert on this, so I'm really having to take a cue from what the government agencies are saying and what the media is reporting.
Well, we'll keep our watching brief on that, and you know, fingers crossed that something you'd have to see unexpected happens to reduce the spread of coronavirus. It seems inevitable, but we don't really know, as you say, Lionel, how governments are going to respond, and ultimately they will decide what happens or doesn't happen. But at the moment, as things stand, Daniel, you're going to Paris-Nice at the weekend. You're lining up there with Primoz Roglic and, well, Tadej Pogacar is on the...
Rog and Pog.
Who
Nairo
else?
Nairo Man. Superman.
Wow.
Anyone Quite riding who doesn't have a nickname?
Egan Bernal doesn't
Richie
have a nickname.
Richie
Port,
mate.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good field, isn't it?
Yes, it is. The sprinter, very strong sprinters, sprinting field as well. Caleb Ewan, Sam Bennett, Mads Pedersen, world champion, of course. What did you make of his performances at the weekend?
He was very visible, but I guess that's a consequence of the having the rainbow jersey on your back. He's been sort of in a team role, hasn't he, so far this year, Tour Down Under, and even at the weekend there, you know, Jasper Stuyvesant was obviously in great form, but as you said earlier, you know, we can maybe read too much into Het Nieuwsblad for looking further down the line at Tour of Flanders and Paris-Roubaix. And he's it's hard to know how much you're spotting him because he's riding well and how much you're spotting him because he's so visible in that rainbow jersey. But he does seem to be very, very visible at the moment.
Got to bear in mind that his teammate was in what turned out to be the winning break. Well, yeah. So, I mean, once Stuyven got into that break, he was, you know, sat in his armchair, wasn't he, waiting. So,
Pino as well, we forgot. Paris-Nice and Landa.
Yeah, Mikel Landa, Barry McLaren, Ivan Garcia. I was surprised not to see him at the weekend, actually. He's a good classics rider. And Stefan Kung from Groupama FDJ, who has his own song. Did you know that?
No, I did not.
Yeah, he has his own Belgian song that was invented or created by his Belgian fan club. And it was played at the team's presentation on Saturday morning. Very rousing indeed it was.
How does it go?
Well, shall we hear it? Here it is.
Applause for the men and vrouwen van Groupama FDJ and FDJ Nouvelle Aquitaine Fitogoscope.
Good morning, Stefan Kung.
Good morning, everyone.
Big smile on your face. Is it because of the song?
Yeah, it makes me smile all the time. It's my Belgian fan club, King King Freunde, who wrote this song.
They're here! Waar zijn de King Kong Freunde? It's a Freund, it's one Freund.
I mean, not the best recording, and only, unfortunately, I could hear it well in the arena, in the velodrome there in Ghent, but I couldn't, it doesn't come across quite so well there, but hopefully you get the rough idea.
I've got right. Ackermann as well among the sprinters. How could I forget him?
Ackermann.
No, Buchmann, I don't think.
No. Well, we look forward to Paris-Nice, and you'll be there, of course, Daniel, and Tirreno Adriatico next week as well, if all goes well. Should we wrap things up for this week, chaps?
Indeed.
I think we'd better.
Lionel, will you be back next week?
I will, yes, one way or the other. Well, who knows?
Before we wrap things up this week, a couple of announcements. Lionel's excellent conversation with Jani Brajkovic has gone online this week for Friends of the Cycling Podcast. It's a great listen. It's called A Private Battle, and Brajkovic is very open and honest about some of the problems he's had in his career, including disordered eating, which became an eating disorder, and it's a fascinating listen. So that's available for friends of the podcast. Sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com. We've also released this week the latest episode of Service Course, episode number 6, which comes after episode number 7 last month. Slight miscounting there, but episode 6 is called New Kit Day, and it's all about some of the new kit that professional riders are on in 2020. Lizzie Banks of Bigla Katusha and Tom Wally present that, and Lizzie was 6th at the weekend at Het Nieuwsblad, rode extremely well, so she's made a good start to the year. And it's a fascinating listen. We hear from Cannondale about why they are sponsoring 3 women's teams this year. That's really interesting. So Service Course, available now. Check it out. Before we go, some thank yous to friends of the podcast. And I must say also, thanks to Kieran Barry. Kieran has been trying desperately to have his name read out at in this part of the podcast. And I said on our Facebook discussion group that I would read his name out if he did. One way I said was by doing something eye-catching. So on Saturday with his friend Young Carl, they became the first to successfully Everest the stunning Hai Van Pass in Vietnam, where I think he is based. A 400-kilometre, 9,000-metre, 24-hour effort that nearly broke both of us. He sent some absolutely incredible pictures through as well. So thanks for that, Kieran, and congratulations on a great achievement. Thanks also to Graham McKenzie, Tony Hawking, Alistair Cross, Christopher Cahey, David Johnson, Holt Hanna, Jason Moyer, Jonathan Giftos, and Colin Willis.
And from me, from all of us, thanks to Matt Clover, Martin Sinclair, Jason Vian, Paul Mottram, Anthony Clements, Brian Forrester, Peter Bowman, Paul McAlevey, David Campion, Colin Tierney.
And a big thank you to Russell Komesaruk, James Hayduck, Martin Norris, Nigel Manson, Chris Collier, Todd Collins, Oliver Holmes, Guy Furness, and Martin Hassel. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Lionel. Enjoy your holiday.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you, Daniel.
Thanks, Napalm.
Well, just finally this week, I've got rid of Daniel and Lionel, so I can mention the shows that I'm doing in the US with Ian Boswell on April the 8th in New York City at Rafa in New York, and then on April the 10th in, well, not in Washington, D.C., apparently, but in Mount Rainier, which is right beside Washington, D.C., but is in Maryland at the Red Dirt Studios on April the 10th. Tickets at thecyclingpodcast.com. And if you're a junior cyclist or you know junior cyclists and you'd like to come along to the event at the Red Dirt Studios, please email me, richard@thecyclingpodcast.com. We may have a special deal for you. So please, if you're a junior cyclist or you know some junior cyclists in the area, email me, richard@thecyclingpodcast.com. And I hope to see lots of you in New York and Washington on April the 8th, April the 9th, that's a sold-out show in Washington, D.C., and April the 10th in Mount Rainier.